make a point of that. He is reader in mathematics at the University of Oxford and fellow in mathematics and philosophy of science at Green College, University of Oxford. He holds doctorates from Oxford, from Cambridge, and the prestigious DSC, the kind of the doctorate beyond a doctorate at from the University of Wales, and an MA in bioethics from the University of Surrey. In addition to authoring over 70 peer-reviewed papers in pure mathematics and co-authoring two research monographs for Oxford University Press, he is the author of the newly released book, God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God? God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God? This came out September 21st. And John is weighing in on the science-religion debate. The book is available at Milestone Books, and I'm sure you can get it from Amazon and any of a number of other locations. John is a dear friend of mine, and we have worked together on a number of projects, both in the UK and here. And before he comes up, so you'll get a little bit of a flavor for him and for this film that we've just produced. I'm just going to show you the beginning of this film, and you will. John and I occasionally have done this where I just play a little bit of the role of the interviewer and maybe the occasional antagonist, but John came in late last night from the UK, so he might be just a little overwrought, but we're delighted that he is here with us. John, let me start where that left off. At the end of that, I say that this is not just a debate that takes place in the academic environment, but it's one that's relevant to every Christian and every individual. How so? The science-religion debate.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. I must say thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you again. I feel almost at home. So thank you very much indeed. I think this debate is enormously relevant because of the cultural power of science. We all have benefited from the spin-offs of science and technology. I expect you were grateful for that as your GPS told you where the country club was this morning. And we appreciate the genius that's gone into unraveling some of the deeper mysteries of the universe. And what has happened is that the cultural authority of science has been coupled by certain people with atheism. And therefore, the story that's being told is that we are in a universe ultimately empty of meaning. There's just matter and energy. And matter and energy have managed somehow to produce everything we see. We don't need God. And we don't need God because there isn't a God. And so therefore, it's very important, because this is grasping the minds of increasing numbers of people. Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, has sold well over 1 million copies in English. And that shows that he's reaching a nerve of people who really want to be told that there is no God. So the story is of immense importance. Larry, that's how I'd start that anyway.
How many of you have read The God Delusion? Is there any here who have read The God Delusion? There are a few of you. How many of you are familiar with Richard Dawkins? Why don't you just tell us just a bit about Richard Dawkins and about this book?
Well, Richard Dawkins was voted by Prospect Magazine, wasn't he, as one of the three leading intellectuals in the world. And he is currently regarded as the intellectual leader of what are called the New Atheists. And over here, you'll be familiar with Sam Harris and his Letter to a Christian Nation, or Christopher Hitchens in his recent book, God is Not Great. And there is a movement to bring these people together. Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, says that atheists are very independent-minded. They're like cats. And it's very difficult to herd cats. But if you get them together in sufficient numbers, they can make a colossal noise. So what he is doing is orchestrating the cats, so to speak, and getting them to give a more united and concertedly aggressive, evangelistic, I could call it, crusade of atheism in the contemporary world. It's growing in France. It's growing in Germany, where traditionally there hasn't been a great deal of interest. His book is shot to being number one on the bestseller list just the week after its publication. He started as a zoologist in Oxford University and then became the first Charles Simonyi holder of the professorship at Oxford for the public understanding of science. Charles Simonyi, as many of you will know, is the number two in Microsoft. And since then, he's been promoting science. He's a brilliant writer. He's brilliant at explaining some of the wonders of the living world. But he is using his science as a vehicle to communicate atheism. And so the atheism has come much more to the fore and is now becoming much more overt and aggressive. His stated aim in his book is that he wants somebody who picks the book up to be an atheist by the time they set it down. And so it seems to me it's very important that also at an intellectual level, we step out into the public and stick our heads, some of us, above the parapet to show that his thesis is false. That you don't have to be a faith head, as he calls it. You don't have to commit intellectual suicide to believe in the God who's revealed himself in the Bible. Far from it. I want to argue that science, far from burying God, is on the side of God. And that's why I wrote the book that Larry has mentioned, God's Undertaker. Has science buried God? Absolutely not, is the thesis developed in this book, in case you might have any doubt about it.
Gentlemen, in the last year, we have seen no less than 5 New York Times bestsellers by atheists promoting atheism. Now, this is unprecedented. We have seen a rise in interest in the so-called new atheism, and hence we want to bring some public attention to this, that people will take these kinds of issues seriously. Churches have a tendency to be very insular in their focus, and that is to say the typical pastor, quite understandably, is focused on the issues of his flock, that is to say other Christians or other people who would profess Christ, and not necessarily being aware of the larger cultural pulse. So we hope that in this to bring something of a larger perspective on this. What's really new about the new atheists? Just this evangelical kind of approach?
I think that's right. I think there's nothing really new. They call themselves, interestingly enough, the Brights. The rest of us are the Dims, of course, gentlemen. The Brights. And they've used that deliberately to refer to the Enlightenment in the 18th century. They feel that what they're doing is recovering the spirit of the Enlightenment, as if no one had ever thought a sensible thought before the Enlightenment. And they want to recover that, and they want to make a concerted attack rather than just little attacks here and there. And what they are principally targeting is the respect that society in the West, of course, it's not true all over the world, but the respect that society shows towards religion. They'll talk about, why does every show at ethics have to have a bishop on it? Or why does every convention that's discussing, let's say, poverty, have to have a religious person on it? And why do we defer to religious people? We ought to treat religion without kid gloves like we treat everything else. And so the idea is to, as Dawkins puts it in his book, to increase the consciousness of atheists and everybody else to be proud of their atheism, to come out, so to speak, for their atheism, and to stand tall that they've nothing to be ashamed of. Now, I find that very remarkable as a European, because the difficult thing in Europe is not to be an atheist. That's easy, because that's the default position in academia. It's the default position in the media. The hard thing in Europe is to be a Christian. And you will find yourself the subject of embarrassed conversation and so on and so forth. Now, it may be a little bit different in North America. So it seems to me, in a way, there's nothing new. And I think, in response to what you said earlier, Larry, about pastors and so on, I think it's very good for us to remember, gentlemen, that when Christianity burst in the world 20 centuries ago, it was utterly new. And the early apostles faced a task that's increasingly like the task we face today. When Paul went to Athens, particularly sitting in front of him, were representatives of the two major philosophical schools that have split the world before and since. There were some people who believed that the world could not explain itself. You needed something transcendent. People like Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, they may have had relatively vague concepts of God, but they knew that the universe did not explain itself. Over against them were folks like the Epicurean philosophers, going back to Democritus and Leucippus, who believed that matter and energy are all you've got. The universe explains itself. And life explains itself in terms of purely material, unguided, mindless processes. And when Paul went to meet them and came into the middle with an utterly new message, which centered on the fact that Jesus Christ had literally risen again as a fact of history, that spoke to both those groups. But he was facing many atheists. And when he got to talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, a great titter went round the audience. And they laughed at him because, of course, they knew, because they were Greeks, that he wasn't talking about a vague survival of Jesus after the death. He was talking about bodily resurrection, anastasis, standing up again. And they laughed because they felt that, of course, the philosophers had long since shown that this was impossible. So Paul was up against the laughter of the atheists in the ancient world. And what I feel is going to happen in Western society, it's already happening in Europe in a very big way, that we are going to have to face that, that we're in a minority as Christians. And so therefore we're going to have to, if we're going to reach across the divide, so to speak, we are going to have to get back into the methodology of the early Christian apostles as they spoke into the ancient world. What I'm saying is this, gentlemen, in Europe particularly, and it may happen here, I don't know, but in Europe particularly, the contemporary world is becoming more and more like the ancient world.
John, I've been asked this many times, and you probably have too. What's the point of a debate like this? And by that, I don't mean the cultural debate per se. I mean what's going to take place on Wednesday night. Why does something like that matter? I mean, the majority of people here, the vast majority, maybe all of them, how many of you are in work that is in a scientific field? So I see just a few hands. So there would be many who would say that this kind of thing is just largely irrelevant to them. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's not irrelevant to them. I sat on the plane yesterday with a number of businessmen, and I started talking. Within 5 seconds, one of these businessmen who works for a big, big telecommunications concern said, "I'm a Dawkins man. I'm an atheist." So I started way an atheist. So we got into it for about an hour talking on the plane. I think the point is that what happens at the academic and intellectual level has a very strong trickle-down effect. And even if people don't understand all the arguments, they are strongly influenced by them. And of course, in the ancient world, it's very interesting. Lucretius, the famous Latin poet, who was an Epicurean philosopher, wrote a brilliant poem. And in it he said how wonderful it is there's no God. Because the atoms of our bodies, when we die, they fly apart and we're gone. There's nothing left. And that means we don't have to face God. There's no judgment. So what they did was they used their materialism, that is their belief that this universe is all that there is, as a kind of gospel to liberate them from what they thought was a tyranny of religion. Now, that's exactly what the new atheists say. You're under a tyranny of religion. God makes you feel guilty. God's always around the corner seeing if you're enjoying yourself, and he wants to put a stop to it. God's always putting a brake on what you'd like to do with yourself, and so on and so forth. So what is happening is they are presenting themselves as liberators. Now, the general public may know very little about science, but they respect it. So if someone steps onto the stage as a scientist and says, "I'm here to liberate you from these infantile notions." In his book, Dawkins describes religion like a child sucking, what do you call it here, a comforter?
Yes.
Or a dummy. It belongs to the infantile stage of humanity. Now, I find there are many people out there who don't understand all the intellectual arguments, but they want to hear that message. Because inwardly, they may have had a negative experience of Christianity, or they simply have a sense of rebelling against God. And this message reinforces them enormously. And so, as always, I think, the things that are happening in the academy very soon spill out. And you can see by the response of the general public.
John speaks of the trickle-down effect from the academy into the larger culture. By way of example of that, fairly recently I was speaking to a woman who said this to me. She said, "That which doesn't kill us makes us stronger." Doesn't Proverbs say something like that? Does anyone know who said that? That's Friedrich Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche. You see, she didn't know that, but she had been influenced by that philosophy a century on and was quoting it. So there's certainly a trickle-down effect. John, how about this? There are those who would say, in fact, there are Christians who are kind of comfortable with the idea that Stephen Jay Gould set forward, in which he spoke of non-overlapping magisteria, where you have, that's just a fancy way of saying that there are disciplines that remain separate. They're mutually exclusive. And so Christianity is over here, and science is over here. And some Christians are very comfortable with that, the idea that the scientists will stick to their thing and Christians will sort of stay out of it. What's wrong with that paradigm?
Well, in one sense, it's not completely wrong, in that certainly we can see that science answers certain questions, asks and answers certain questions, like, how does this work? Christianity is not asking that particular question. The Bible doesn't teach me my algebra. Of course not, nor my atomic physics. But the problem with Noma is that if you keep science and your faith in God in two utterly separate compartments, what you'll find is that the small print in Stephen Jay Gould's is this: science deals with reality, religion deals with everything else, fairy stories, Santa Claus, and Jesus. Do you see? In other words, it's saying that if you want to be interested in reality, then that's science. Religion deals with everything else. Now, I want to say that's utterly false. But secondly, I would like to say that there is a real overlap. The Bible tells me that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That is a statement about the real physical universe. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. All things came to be through Him. That is a statement about the physical universe. So science talks about the physical universe, and the Bible talks about the physical universe, so there's bound to be an overlap. So we cannot rush away and hide with the view that science and faith in God are in totally separate compartments. But the other thing, the other very wrong impression that view gives is this: that in science we got facts, in Christianity we got faith, and of course then it's not worth talking about. That is nonsense, gentlemen. Every scientist has to have a very strong faith. In what? In the intelligibility of the universe. You can see that, can't you? If you're going to do science, you have to believe that the universe can in part be understood. And what I want to say there is, Christianity gives a basis for that, atheism does not. Because atheism tells me that my brain and my mind, which is just an epiphenomenon of the brain, the thoughts in my mind are simply, in the end, the results of the motions of atoms randomly through mindless processes. Well, why should I trust them then? Why should I trust the theories that my brain spins if it itself is a product of random mindless processes? Whereas Christianity is telling me the reason that your mind in there can understand a little bit of the universe out there is that both were created by the same intelligent God. God created the universe out there and He created the mind in here. So for those two or three reasons, it seems to me to be very important that we don't get too allured by that path. Otherwise, we'll find ourselves being forced more into the private sphere. Your faith is what you keep for yourself in your devotions, in your family, in your bedroom. And science, etc., is for the big, real world. I don't believe that for a moment. It's very important that my faith is real in my family and my devotions. But it's got to be real in the marketplace or else it ain't worth believing. It's got to have a bottom line. I've got to be able to stand up with integrity amongst my fellow men and women and say what I believe and articulate it and give reasons for it. And what's going to happen, I think, and it's in part another answer to your early question, Larry. You know, in the New Testament, we're told that it was written in a time when Christians were coming under increasing pressure from the Roman police and they were beginning to be attacked and suffer. And Peter says, you know, don't be afraid of what they're afraid of. The biggest problem that I have, to be honest with you men, and it's good to be among men because we can be honest, the biggest problem is fear. Fear of other men. Fear of the community around. If I stand up and be counted, what are they going to think of me? Are they going to give me the next deal? Are they going to trust me the next time I see them? Are they going to think I'm a clothhead or an idiot? It's fear. And I'm fascinated that one of the things that Jesus talks about and his apostle talks about very sensitively is that question of fear that gnaws at our heart and privatizes us and keeps us quiet and closes us down. And what Peter says is this: don't be afraid of their fear, but do what? Sanctify in your hearts Jesus as Lord and be ready to give an answer to everybody who asks you a reason concerning the hope that is in within you. So if Christ is real, and of course I'm speaking now as a Christian, as you see, if Christ is real to us, then we can take that step without fear and start to try to answer the questions that are being asked in the marketplace. And then we'll soon discover that this is very relevant.
John raises two really important points there. One is the way that this particular debate is framed. It's not framed science versus religion. You see, once you accept that paradigm, you've lost. You see, because that's fact versus fiction. Furthermore, it's not framed as as the God delusion versus religion in some general sense. Rather, it is his assertions, Richard Dawkins' assertions in the God delusion over and against specifically the Christian faith. Dawkins has a tendency to see, as many do, religion in a very monolithic sense. And what we're seeking to do is to assert the uniqueness of Christ. John Lennox doesn't have an interest in defending suicide bombing. You see, so there are, do you?
No, even though I'm from Ireland.
So there's no particular desire on our part to defend the totality of religious belief. And the second thing is this, that if you think an issue like this doesn't matter, then what you're doing is effectively seeding one part of life and saying that your Christian faith doesn't have anything relevant to speak to it. And then what's next? Is it, do you say that politics, you know, faith isn't relevant to politics, faith isn't relevant to the schools, faith isn't relevant, and you see what happens is you go completely underground with your Christian faith. John, let me ask you a more personal question. How did you become a Christian?
Well, my parents were believers, and so were their parents, and I think the preceding generation as well. My parents were wonderful people because in a very sectarian country, they allowed me space to think. I owe them an enormous debt for that because many of my contemporaries, when they got away from home, like I did, I went to Cambridge to study in England, which was a long way from home and big new world. But once they got away from the influence of their parents, they just chucked out any sort of faith, if that's what it was, in Christianity, the moment they got from home, because they'd never been allowed to think. But very fortunately, my parents, who were strong believers, realized that I had to become a Christian. Richard Dawkins, in his book, very interestingly, says that we mustn't label people with a religion because they're parents of that particular religion. Well, he's hitting a point, isn't he? That the New Testament teaches so clearly that it's to as many as received Jesus Christ, to him that he gave the right to become children of God. They weren't like that by birth, and that's what my parents taught me. But they give me space to think, and it's very hard, of course, looking back to pinpoint exactly all the history of your own development. But I suppose my first steps towards Christianity were made when I was less than 10 years old. And I started to read a lot. My father was a great reader, although he was not an educated man at all. And he introduced me to people like C.S. Lewis, whom I later was able to listen to. I'm old enough, gentlemen, I'm old enough. Listened to C.S. Lewis in Cambridge in the early 60s. But I suppose a big turning point, Larry, was when I got up to Cambridge. And it was in the first week, I remembered well. A student said to me, "Do you go to church? Do you believe in God?" And then he said, "Of course, you're Irish. Sorry, I forgot. I shouldn't have said that. You know, you all go to church over there and you believe in God and you fight about it." And that was an immense challenge. Was he right? Was my faith simply a product of genetics and heredity? After all, I was surrounded by it. So what I decided to do then, and I've been doing it ever since, was to befriend atheists. And I've done it all over the world, particularly in countries like Russia and the former Soviet bloc, where I traveled for 25 years during the Cold War, talking to people who'd been systematically exposed to atheism in school, in university, and so on, and talking to people in the Academy of Sciences. And what I found was, the more that I exposed my faith to them in debate and in discussion, the stronger it grew, because I could see there were real answers. Larry, you know, I owe you an apology. You asked me why have a debate, and I never even answered the question. I wondered, because my brain's slightly tired along there, but why have a debate? Well, it is important because, firstly, it's what Jesus and the apostles did all the time. Just remember, when Jesus was on earth, there were synagogues, but you'll notice in the New Testament, most of the teaching was open air. It was discussion in the marketplaces. Same with Paul. He reasoned in the marketplace. That was the normal thing. Christianity grew because it was not confined to churches. The churches existed because people became Christians. And they became Christians because they met Christianity usually out in the marketplace. And so that emphasis is very important. Secondly, the objection, why have a debate, often comes from people who say something like this: "Look, I'm sure of my relationship with God. All this reasoning and argumentation, that's like telling a sheep that it can't know who the shepherd is until it has had a long philosophical argument about whether the shepherd exists or not." Well, that would be utterly absurd. The sheep knows the shepherd. And so I know God through Christ. Well, wonderful. Absolutely. That is one half of the story. And that's the wonder of the Christian faith. After all, gentlemen, if the Christian faith were only for people who could understand a vast chain of philosophical argument and come to a conclusion, well, most of us would be written out, wouldn't we? And therefore, it wouldn't be credible. God, the God who created the universe, hasn't left us to find him simply by the exercise of our own rationality. He's taken the initiative and revealed himself, and he's given each of us that capacity that we can get to know God, and so that we can get to be certain of our relationship with him. And just as you business people, there are many of you in the room, when you're meeting someone for the first time and you're entering into a deal, you are brilliant at judging, is this person trustworthy? Isn't that what happens when you first meet? You're reading all the body language and what's being said. Can I really trust this person? That's exactly what happens when we come to consider Jesus Christ. And the trust grows through his self-revelation of himself. So I want to emphasize that. But there are two sides. There's a subjective side to our faith, but there's an objective side. As you saw me say in the DVD, Christianity, I believe, is true. It's objectively true. And that's what validates our subjective experience. Now, the Apostle Paul was a towering intellect. And when he stood up on the steps of the Roman fortress of Antonia, Jerusalem, and spoke Greek to the surprise of the Roman centurion and said he wanted to talk to the crowd. And he looked over this crowd that were wanting to tear him to pieces. And he said to them, "Listen," he said, "I studied under the best teacher in the Jewish religion, Gamaliel." I can imagine there were a lot of ordinary people in that crowd, fearful, who were Christians. They weren't as bright as Paul, but they were very thankful that a man like Paul existed to defend the faith out there for them. So there are two sides. And that's why I feel we need these debates, Because if we don't do them, gentlemen, do you know what's going to happen? The new atheists are going to say, look, where's the opposition? There's no one to stand up for God. And that's going to send a message, a powerful message out into society. And once that begins to snowball, there'll be no stopping. So if we can't do it ourselves, but I believe we can do a lot ourselves, in our own circles, at our own level, talking to people, introducing them to ideas, using things like the tools we've tried to create for you, and other things as well, and then discussing them at our own level. That's how I started. I couldn't articulate these things as students. So what did I do? We didn't have DVDs, they weren't invented. So I got a tape, you know, big reel tape, and I brought a few friends into my room in Cambridge, and they said, look, I can't explain this stuff. I want you to listen to this for 10 minutes. So we listened for 10, and they said, turn it off. Okay, turned it off. And then we talked. And that's how I started. And I would encourage you, because it's the sort of thing, I used to do it, my first job in Toronto. I was 17, and I was employed in a research laboratory, and I got the director of the company, the co-director, and the staff. What do you do at lunchtime? Well, we have sandwiches. I said, would you listen to a bit of a tape? Well, this was a novelty. So here, me, a 17-year-old, and I played a bit of this tape. And soon, every lunchtime, we had everybody from the top men in the company, and of course, I was just a little boy. But we had tremendous discussions. If we can't do it ourselves, we can learn to do it by using the tools that other people create for us. So debate is very important. Does that now answer your question?
Indeed. A recent article in the Daily Mail, UK paper, major UK paper, was titled precisely that, I think, Will No One Stand Up for God? Will No One Stand Up for God? This new atheist movement has really gained momentum in the UK. Much more so than here, I think. Yeah, you know, I'm processing what you're saying, as I think a number of men out here might be processing it and saying, okay, well, that's great. You're an Oxford professor. You've got 3 PhDs. You know, how am I supposed to engage? How can I do the kind of things that you're talking about? How can I get out into the marketplace and defend my faith and share it?
Well, the first thing is, if we're Christians, no one can take our experience from us. That's number one. I can always share my experience, and that's very important to make it personal. Secondly, I can identify the questions people are asking, and they're asking them. And you're bound to find, I find in Oxford, there's so many people cleverer than I am. It's all a relative thing. And I meet questions very frequently that I don't know the answers to. So what do? I say to the person, you know, that's a very interesting question. I've never thought about it before. Give me a chance to think about it. And that often opens up the relationship. The important thing is when that first fear pressure comes and we feel vulnerable, we feel we're about to expose our ignorance, the best thing to do is expose the ignorance. And you make a friend. Oh, so you don't feel you know all the answers? Of course not. What do you think I am? But I want to think about it. And I've often found, gentlemen, that just that simple gesture of acknowledging that I don't understand the question, the person said, oh, well, that's not really what's bothering me. But then you get down to something else, you know. It becomes real. So I would say that is the first thing, Larry, that in whatever circles we are, we've got people that trust us and are confident in us and are interested in us. The second thing I'd say is if we want people to be interested in us, we must be interested in them. And usually when I meet someone for the first time, I will keep asking them questions until they ask me one. I just go on asking questions until they ask me one. Because I know that until they ask me one, they're not interested in what I'm saying. And this is very simple, isn't it? Goodness me. All these people from Birmingham, Alabama here at the top end of society. This is very simple stuff, isn't it? But I find these things help enormously in our relationships with other people. My objective is to build relationships, build friendships with people, because I believe that God has sent Christ into the world to befriend me. And it's cost him an awful lot to do it. And the very least I can do is extend that friendship a little bit.
John,
so that's the kind of motivation.
John was quoting Peter's epistle, always be ready to give answer or defense for the hope that is in you with gentleness and respect. Always be ready to give answer or defense for the hope that is in you. And what I would say to you is you begin with that. You don't have to defend the hope that is in me.
No.
You don't have to defend the hope that it's in Richard. In other words, you're not called to defend the totality of the Christian faith. You can't. John Lennox, as clever as he is, he's not prepared to do that. So, but can you defend your story? Can you defend your experience? If you can do that, you can start working out little by little and start making those circles around you just a little bit larger and speak to other things as well. John, how long have you been preparing for this debate?
63 years. No, not quite, but there is a very real sense in which that is true. I've been preparing for this all my life. It's a very unique opportunity, actually, and it's very significant. I think it's happening here. I count this as an enormous honor, you know, to be involved in it. But do you mean immediate preparation?
Yes.
Well, I've been working on it for 3 months, all the time. And that means sometimes 12 hours a day. But that's letting you into a secret, because it may not go very well. It's very daunting. You can never be too well prepared. So, does that answer your question?
It does indeed. Gentlemen, for those of you who are so inclined, we would seek your prayer. You know, there are many, I think, who have heard John speak on a number of occasions and who have said to me, very well intentioned, you know, John's just going to wipe him out. You know, he's just so clever. If we put our faith and our trust in a man, it's a shallow hope.
Mm-hmm.
Our hope must be in the power of Jesus Christ working in the lives of individuals. And so I very unashamedly seek your prayer. For us, as there will be millions listening to this, not just the 1,300 who are there in the Alice Stevens Center, but it will be broadcast globally. And not often do we get the chance to share the gospel on that kind of scale. So we want to take it very, very seriously, and we want to make sure that Christ is honored in all things. John, do you have any final thoughts as we close?
No, I would just echo that. I think that this is not a case of winning or losing. What we're out to do is to try to faithfully represent what I believe to be the biblical truth of the revelation of Jesus Christ. And above all, what I'm concerned about, gentlemen, is that he is honored and that I do not misrepresent him in any way. It is an awesome responsibility to talk to people about God in that kind of situation, because they could get the wrong impression. It is also vastly important that I show the Spirit of Christ. We do not answer insult by insult. Not that there will be any of that. But if we do not show the Spirit of the Lord Jesus in the way in which we handle people who disagree profoundly from us, we've lost anyway, haven't we? Speaking the truth in love is one of the hardest Christian commandments, injunctions to live out, isn't it? So I shall be grateful. For those of you who believe in prayer, I will be encouraged if you pray. And for those of you who aren't believers but are thinking about it, I hope that the debate will give you an opportunity to think about something that's not in your face or down your throat. I believe very strongly that Christ, he refused to be protected by physical weapons, because you cannot get people to love you by force. You cannot convince people of truth by suicide bombing. And that's where Jesus is unique. You can convince people by going to a cross and dying and rising again. Thank you very much, gentlemen.